Good morning, members of the commission, Secretary Hepler, Keith Fisk. I'm the administrator of the statewide wildlife damage program. Today with me, I have Nathan Baker to my left. He's the resource supervisor, terrestrial resource supervisor here in central South Dakota. And then to his left is Brad Janicki. He's a local wildlife damage specialist located in Fort Pierre and serves the producers in Stanley, Jones, and portion of Lyman County. If you recall from the last meeting, Commissioner Olson had requested that we do informational item in regards to how our agency responds to coyote depredation events, and that presentation will be provided and tag team here by Nathan and Brad, and then we can certainly address any questions, and then I'll also provide a brief update in the external review that's ongoing currently of our program that we spoke about in May, just to give you folks an update on that. So with that, I'll turn it over to Nathan and Brad.
Thanks, Keith. Yes, yeah, so Brad and I will just go over a presentation. I think it was asked on what's the standard response to a wildlife damage complaint, specifically a coyote complaint, kind of from start to finish. So we'll kind of cover from the moment that we receive it to when the complaint is resolved. Just a little background information to get started. So we refer to, you know, coyote complaints or requests for service, most commonly referred to as complaints. You know, what are those complaints regarding? It's for the most part it's livestock, you know, loss or damage. And in the last fiscal year that we just ended, FY19, 69% of the coyote damage complaints that came in were related to cattle. The second most was sheep, which was at 25%, and then it kind of goes down from there. Domestic 3%, poultry, and then I think horse and other there. Domestic would probably be like an example would be somebody's, you know, dog, or a coyote came into the dog or into a yard and maybe was harassing somebody's pets or their dog. So, you know, we get a few complaints like that. The last fiscal year that just ended, on June 30th, we had a little over 1,100 coyote complaints or requests for service to our staff from folks across the state. And with those, little over 6,000 coyotes were removed by our staff. And so the damage is livestock for the most part, cattle and sheep. So then what type of complaints or what's the form of those complaints that they come in to us? And so the top two are livestock loss, so a kill. So somebody is calving or lambing and they have a coyote that comes in and it physically kills a calf or a lamb or a ewe, so on and so forth. We also have some complaints that are just maintenance. So maybe a producer that, you know, just where they're set up and their operation and, you know, based on the terrain and the habitat that, you know, they're going to always have, you know, coyote complaints where, you know, coyote harassing livestock, you know, every spring. So there's some maintenance complaints that we'd work that, you know, we go in and, you know, right before they calve or right before they lamb, try to create a little bit of buffer and remove a few coyotes around there to help them out, because we know that, you know, they've had, you know, coyote losses, you know, the last several years. They're probably going to have them again this year. Two other complaints are that we commonly get is just noise complaints or observe them. So, you know, a couple of coyotes can sound like 15 coyotes, you know, and, you know, I heard a bunch of coyotes out there. You know, it's not really tied to, they weren't harassing livestock, there was no loss yet or anything associated with it. And then the other ones, they observed coyotes. You know, I saw a couple moving through the pasture out there. Again, not an actual complaint or no loss or any, or, you know, livestock harassment had occurred, you know, but they may notify our staff and just, you know, to let them know that, you know, there are coyotes out there, we've been seeing them, we've been hearing them. And then so we'll kind of get into the response protocol. So how are these requests received? A lot of times it's direct contact right to our wildlife damage specialist. So a producer may call Brad directly. And that's usually, you know, producers that have had their wildlife damage specialist out there working on their property before. They know them, you know, repeat customers, they'll just call them directly. If it's a producer maybe new to the area or, you know, hasn't had a loss or anything for 10 or 15 years, they may contact our conservation officers first. Our officers are the most visible staff that are out there in the field, so you know they get all sorts of questions, and they commonly get questions from a producer or an operator that I've got some coyotes, or I just had a coyote kill one of my calves last night, what can you do? And then they'll route it to our wildlife damage specialist, and then our wildlife damage specialist will follow up directly with that producer. They may go right to the GFP regional office or district offices. We may talk to one of our secretaries. They'll take their information as well and then refer it to our wildlife damage specialist, who then, give them a phone call, follow up with them in regards to that. I've also had some that just go straight to the sheriff's office, depending on, if they're see the sheriff, or depending on the situation. Like I said, they go to our conservationers quite frequently, and also sometimes to the sheriff's office to relay that complaint, and which then it may go to a conservation officer, route it back to a wildlife damage specialist, and then they'll get in direct contact with that producer. And then so once the complaint is received, I'll turn it over to Brad, and as our field specialist, the wildlife damage specialist, to kind of go over, once he receives a complaint, what does he do with it from there?
Okay, so as Nathan said, I'll just continue on, is what happens when we do get that phone call or complaint. The first response is usually conducted within 48 hours. Most responses are made within 24. Now, keep in mind, this could be a simple phone call, or it could be an on-site visit. It just all depends on the complaint. To give you some perspective, we work 40-hour weeks. We don't always work Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. We have somewhat unique hours, so we work weekends, nights, early mornings, early evenings, late evenings. It just kind of depends on your workload, and you're prioritizing each complaint and call that comes in. It's not really a cut and dry, every week's going to be the same. Another thing to keep in mind, within those work weeks, I know this presentation is just on coyotes. We have other job duties. So we have survey work. We have beaver damage we also take care of. There's goose depredation. There's deer depredation, which last winter was kind of a large workload with the exceptional winter we had. There's prairie dog work as well. So it isn't, our job duty isn't just coyotes. It is other duties as well. But getting back to this, so you get to the on-site investigation, you're usually with a producer that, if it's a new producer that's called you, you're gonna meet with him, develop that relationship. He doesn't know you or she, so you're gonna go out there, meet with them, find out what the complaint exactly is. Is it a kill? Is it, like Nathan said, are they starting a calve? Are they starting a lamb? Are these just, they're seeing coyotes, etc. Determine if there is damage. If it's a new producer, a lot of times, like I said, we meet with them, and then we have two forms that they need to sign that are releases for us. So there's our state Game Fish and Parks release form, and then there's also the Wildlife Services federal form, which is for our airplane. So after meeting with them, you can usually make a plan of attack as to how you're going to remove those coyotes. And go on from there. That'd be probably more for if that's a new producer that you're working with. If it's somebody you've worked with in the past, a lot of times they're just going to call you or even text you and say, hey, I'm starting to see him, I'm calving in a week, or I've got a kill, this is where it's at, and you've built that relationship and that trust with that producer. He just pretty much cuts you loose, and you know what's expected. And from there, like I said, either situation, you determine what's going to be the best resolution and what will occur when. As far as coyote removal methods, I'd like to say that of the list of them up here, I could use these on every complaint, but unfortunately every producer has a different operation. Every complaint's different. There's a lot of guys that are calving and they're using up every square inch, or they're calving pasture, they're moving pairs, or they've got dogs that are coming out. You can't set traps. So calling is one option. Night work, we do, like I said, I do quite a bit of night stuff with night vision or thermal imaging. We work weekends, nights, etc. Aerial work with the airplane. We have a federal airplane that's based in Pierre that we're using. So that's always another option. Denning and then tracking. Last winter, like I said, was pretty exceptional with the amount of snow. And it was unique in the fact a lot of times you couldn't get to the producer that had the complaint. So there was quite a few occasions I had to just park and track coyotes on foot. And then, of course, our bread and butter is trapping, use of traps and snares, M44s. But like I said, not all those options are available, and then you have to tailor it to your producer, your complaint, and your workload and time that you have to be as efficient as possible in a 40-hour work week at these complaints. Technical assistance, there's not really a whole lot of technical assistance we can give when it comes to coyote complaints, unless it's something as simple as my dog got out last night to go to the bathroom and I heard some coyotes howling. What am I supposed to do? Most times if people have complaints, it tailors to livestock, we're going to show up and take care of that problem. When is a coyote complaint resolved? This is going to probably get different answers across the board, and like I said, in my territory, if somebody's calving or lambing and they have a complaint, and they have a kill or there's coyotes showing up, I'm going to be there camped out on them until they're either done or the producer says otherwise. I have some producers that are going to say, hey, I want you here, I'm calving February 9th and I'm going to start, I want you here before then, remove them. A lot of times you know who's had problems in the past or where the coyotes are thick in the wintertime, so you can go in early and remove those. Other times the producers just want you there during calving season and no other time. And then you have producers that want you there year round. So there's quite a variable of when it's actually resolved. Some of the things you can do to somewhat resolve them as you're going through a checklist would be, there's no more coyote sign. You're not able to locate, you're not hearing them howl. The rancher producer is not seeing or hearing them. Calving or lambing season's over. And now there's a lot of producers that are trucking cattle across the state now to get to pasture. So maybe they're done calving and they're moving pairs across the state. So there's no cattle to protect anymore. And then, like I said, producer's direction is a big one. Those are the relationships you gain. And you build that trust with that producer, and you know what he expects out of you and what you can use on his land as well as surrounding landowners. And with that's pretty much wraps it up. If you have any questions.
Questions, Commissioner Olson?
Nope.
Sure, you go ahead. Have it.
Thanks for that presentation, gentlemen. I've got a few questions. Can I just take the liberty, Mr. Chair, to ask them one after another?
Is
there?
Sure.
Yes. You talked about thermal gear, and that's a pretty interesting technology. I've seen it, never used it myself on anything, but are you, how many people in your division, if you will, or how many other state trappers have access to the thermal gear? Do they all utilize thermal gear? Or if not, how effective is it?
Commissioner Olson, really depends on the region. All of our four administrative regions are outfitted to at least have several different night vision setups. You know, and the technology with night vision and thermal, it's like anything else. You know, 10 years ago, light bulbs were what they were, and now, you know, they last forever. They're way cheaper. So it continues to evolve. And We do have a couple thermal setups, and I know some different regions are starting to put those into their budgets. But it's anything like anything else, you know, it's really expensive, and we have to figure out what's the most effective use of the money. So we're trying to outfit our staff more and more with thermal, but everyone is, or all of the regions are set up to be able to utilize night vision for sure.
Is it effective though? I mean, is that a preferred deal? I mean, to go out and set traps versus using thermals at night, can you go out and get more done then than you do with a conventional trap?
Every complaint's different. There's a lot of, it seems like more and more it's a more useful tool than I probably use it more often than I'm using a lot of other tools, just for the fact that it seems like people are using more of their pasture up, and you don't have that time to go set traps or a place to set them. So it's a tool you definitely is good to have in the toolbox. And then time constraints as well. If you only have 3 hours to be at a complaint, you can go there when the damage is being done, and you're usually a lot more efficient that way.
Okay. So if I'm a landowner and I farm for habitat, if I farm for birds and turkeys and deer, and I have all the food plots, and my neighbor is the one that's the producer and he's raising cattle, and yet the coyotes are either denned up or using my land as kind of their staging area and then going in and raiding my neighbor who's a cattle producer. If I call in the complaint, do you guys answer my complaint, or is it the livestock producer that has to make the complaint?
Commissioner Olson, yeah, generally it's the landowner that has the livestock that's calling in the complaint. And then if there is, you know, I think it maybe even occurs more so East River, where, you know, somebody may be up against a property that has, you know, developed for a wildlife habitat, you know, so there's cover for, you know, coyotes to, you know, hide in, reside in, maybe they're denning over there. So our wildlife damage specialist would, you know, work with that. The livestock producer that has the complaint or is having problems, and then would also, you know, work with you and try to, you know, have you sign one of those releases that would, on those releases, it would, you know, a lot of the tools that Brad went over, you know, you have to check a box, you know, can we use the airplane? Yes, if you can, then you need to fill out the federal one too. Can we use M44 capsules? You may say, no, I don't want that, but you can call them or you can trap them, and then we would work on that. So usually it's the livestock producer that we work on initially, and then we can work surrounding properties if we have, you know, permission and agreement form signed.
Okay. Back when, in a former life, when I was still in the legislature, I carried a funding bill to give a $400,000 appropriation to the department to do more airtime. It wasn't something the department asked for. It was something that, you know, my constituents had said that they felt that there needed to be more airtime, and we actually got that funding through, and I was probably one of the first times I really got to work with the department. I appreciate the minutia that you guys have to go through on your end of things. I've been told, and still have been in contact with a lot of those producers, and I've been told that we do a lot of our airtime in the winter months when there's low to no cover, or we don't utilize those winter months. We do it at other times of the year. Seems to me that it would be more efficient when there's no foliage and wide open snow that you can see the coyotes easier, that we're not doing it then. Is that true? What I've been told, that we don't fly as much in the winter months, and if so, why? Help me understand why we're not.
So a couple things, Commissioner Olson. It's a complex question. So first off, there's two aircraft in South Dakota. They each fly between 500 to 700 hours apiece. And that, you know, that is the bulk of the flying that occurs across the entire state. The timing that the aircraft use is really dependent upon, you know, what the weather conditions are. That's probably the first factor, as well as, you know, what staff workload is. The timing of when producers are going to calve or lamb. You know, let's say that January there is a ton of snow. And, you know, we could certainly go fly some places and kill some coyotes, but if the producers there aren't going to start calving until May, by the time May rolls around, you know, coyotes are going to get sucked into that void, and they're going to have problems right before they calve, even though you flew it prior in January. So it really comes down to timing, and unfortunately, you know, everybody wants the airplane at the same time, and it's hard to get everything scheduled to be able to get everybody taken care of. But again, the airplane is one tool of an entire tool bag. So if staff can't get the airplane, I mean, they still have other tools available that they're very proficient at to be able to remove those critters. I would also say that, you know, flying during the months of March, April, and May, even when there's not snow, you know, the grass is relatively short, starting to green up. Those coyotes show up very well. So it can be super effective during the springtime as well. So a lot of variables that go into that when and where we use the aircraft.
While we're on aircraft, right now I believe it's our policy that if a landowner has a request in to you to have you fly his land, he has to or she has to go around to their neighbors and get them to sign off on you guys being able to fly over their land as well. Why do we put the burden on the landowner to do that task, which to me seems like a perfect opportunity for us to do outreach and landowner relations and quite frankly, just to help fix those relationships?
So that's a great question, Commissioner. So prior to, well, it was a little over a year ago, our staff, for example, would, well, let me back up, I guess. There's two forms in order for our staff to be able to utilize to get on someone's property. There's a state form for our agency, so if Brad's going to go into an area and set traps, he's got to have permission to do that, and the landowner's got to sign off on it. Those are valid for a period of up to 10 years. Then there's another form if we're going to have the airplane be able to be utilized. That's a federal form because we have a partnership with USDA. Those agreements are only good for 5 years. So with the thousands of landowners that we work with every year across the state and the timing of that, you can see that's a significant amount of producers to be able to meet with and talk to them and get those areas signed up. Now, prior to a year and a half ago, some of those instances, you know, maybe there's a producer and he has 10 neighbors. Our staff would give him the packets and then, you know, the landowner would sign off on them and then he'd go talk to his 10 of their neighbors and have them sign up on them because it takes a significant amount of time. Since that, what our agency has done is exactly that, is that we've put that burden back on our staff. Exactly like you said, Commissioner Olson, it's a great opportunity for our staff to develop those relationships, even though it's going to take a significant amount of time of our staff, that they're not going to be setting traps, for example. They are going to be talking to those landowners, tracking them down, and getting them to sign those permissions again within those timelines. So we have moved that way. It's taking more time, but at the end of the day, I believe that the time that's invested there with meeting those landowners and getting those areas signed up is very well spent in the form of landowner relationships. But I would also say that particularly in eastern South Dakota, where you know, a section of ground may have 10 different owners, it takes a significant amount of time, and it has reduced the ability for us to use the aircraft in some areas just because of the volume of contacts that have to be made in certain areas.
Okay, and then my final one, Mr. Chairman. You know, we have our very own kind of Chris Kyle version of coyote sniper and killer. His reputation precedes him. It's just, you know, you talked a little bit about your time and the time allocation, because I know that the producers out there would like to see 100% of your time killing coyotes instead of brood counts or worrying about turkeys or whatever else. What kind of percentage of your time is actually killing coyotes and answering those type of complaints and doing those investigations versus, I mean, I'm looking for, like, is it 30%, is it 40%, 50% of your personal time?
I guess I personally couldn't tell you a percentage. I know in my territory, when my ADC or animal damage work is mostly coyotes, but like I said, yeah, we have surveys, we have other workloads and duties that are part of the job. I guess I couldn't even give you a number on that. It would,
you know, we all of our staff have different codes that they a lot of time too. So when Brad's out there doing coyote control, I mean, he's going to code however many hours that he worked. If he does a brood survey, he's going to be able to code that time. It's highly dependent upon the year, the district, and the demand from the producers. 1 year, Brad may spend 75% of his time doing wildlife damage work, whether it's coyote control or deer damage, and 25% doing surveys. The next year it might be 50-50, the next year it might be 90-10, so it's really dependent upon the weather and what the demand from the producers are. Traditionally, some of our folks out in western South Dakota, where there's higher volumes of livestock, higher emphasis on predator control, they're going to spend 75 to 90% of their time. Maybe in eastern South Dakota, where there's not as much livestock, or they don't have as many problems because they're not on the open prairie, they're penned up. Maybe an individual only spends 40% or 50% of his time on cattle control. So it's really, really variable.
So coyote problems, is that everywhere, the whole state? I mean, from east to west, north to south, or is it more concentrated one place or another? I'm sure it depends on the year.
Yeah, Commissioner Jensen, absolutely. Depends on the year, the weather, coyote populations, wildlife populations, number of livestock, ebbs and flows. But yeah, I mean, we work with producers across the state. Historically, a lot of our work on prairie control is in western South Dakota, where people are out on the open prairies. A lot of sheep left in that area, which are very susceptible to coyotes. In eastern South Dakota, like I said, the animal husbandry practices are a little different. You know, they may lamb inside sheds and keep them in pens close to the house. So it's rare that a coyote would cause a problem in some of those areas. But yeah, we work with producers, about 1,200 of them on an annual year across the state, both east and west.
So in the number of staff that do that sort of work, whether, I guess it's part-time, but I mean, how many staff would that be?
So we have 28 full-time wildlife damage specialists, all responsible for each individual district. It might be one or two counties, it might be three counties, kind of dependent upon where they're at in the state. And that, for the most part, you know, and then if we get a bad winter, we'll certainly rely, it's kind of all hands on deck approach, where we'll rely on wildlife conservation officers or habitat staff to help our staff to be able to get the service around to all the people that need it.
So, and how much money do we spend as a department every year on coyote control responses to coyotes?
Yeah, in a typical year, the wildlife damage program, we spend around $3 to $3.2 million, with right around $1 million or slightly less on predator control.
So, and is that, I mean, both the staff and the money that we spend, is that sufficient, or is it, are you understaffed, underfunded? Do you need more of either?
So what I would say to that question, Commissioner Jensen, is maybe talk a little bit about the external review that Governor's office has ordered. If you recall, at the May meeting, Jason Simmons with the Governor's office provided an update through the campaigning process. Governor Noem had heard concerns from constituents on about the program and if it's working well or if it's not. Are there some improvements that could be made? That very question that you asked is one of the questions that the Wildlife Management Institute's going to address in their review. But we held our first kickoff meeting here, it's probably been about a month ago, and had a very good two-day meeting with those folks, as well as officials from the Department of Agriculture and the Governor's office. We've provided them with a lot of documents, policies, procedures, guidelines, work direction, those types of things. So they're currently starting to go through those things, and then I know in the upcoming months they're going to be doing interviews of our own staff, as well as members of the ADC Policy Advisory Committee and other landowners or constituents that are parts of organizations, executive directors, for example, of the South Dakota Sheep Growers, Stock Growers, Cattlemen, Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, those types of organizations. And then I also believe in order to be able to get at some information from landowners that aren't part of those organizations, they plan to, I believe anyway, develop some type of a survey where people can access a web link and fill out an online survey to be able to gauge some of that information. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention, we did do a survey of producers, all the producers that have received our predator control and beaver control work in 2015. Dr. Cindy Longmire put that together. And at that time, we sent the survey to around 1,300 producers. And at the end of the day, we had about an 80% approval rating, which we felt is pretty competent or pretty good. Are there things that we can do better? Certainly. Are there things that are going to be identified by the external review that we're going to change how we proceed with business? I would imagine very likely. So the conclusion of that will take place. They'll provide the commission a full update at the December meeting, I believe. And then they will also be interviewing and or talking to commissioners over the course of the next 6 months or so. So, if you have comments or questions, certainly you'll be able to have an opportunity to become engaged.
Could you remind us, is the funding, does it come with sportsman license fees again? Is there some general funds?
For the
animal control, or for the predator control?
Yeah, so for the predator control program, it's a pretty complex solution that we have, but there are several different statutes that deal with funding specifically. Part of the money comes from a tax that every county in South Dakota pays based off the number of livestock within a county. There's a different rate that's assessed, and then it's distributed among all taxpayers. Then our agency matches those funds 2-to-1. That generates, our agency's contribution there is around $600,000. The county's is around $300,000. That's around $900,000. And then if you recall, in the legislative session of 2013, we had a dollar surcharge. So when people buy a deer or an antelope tag, there's a $6 surcharge on that license. $1 of that goes to the predator control program, which is around $300,000. And then the other $5 is equally split between our wildlife damage program, so helping producers with deer, turkey, elk depredation, and then the other half of that money goes to our hunter access programs like the walk-in area program. And then most recently here during the legislative session of 2017, I believe, when people buy a small game license at a convenience store or even our website, there's a transaction fee that occurs. It's $4 for residents and $8 for non-residents right now. At that time, it was half of that, and those transaction fees were specifically earmarked in the legislation to go to our wildlife damage program and then also our ADC or our predator control program. And I believe that additional increase provides around $200,000, $250,000 to each one of those components of the program. So it's kind of a long-winded answer.
Yeah, well, thanks. Commissioner Sharp.
Commissioner Sharp here. How has aerial hunting changed over time? Because I remember a time when anybody with a cub would grab somebody else with a gun and they'd go up and, you know, blast away at coyotes, you know, years and years ago, and I'm pretty sure that's not the way you can do it anymore. But my sense is that there might be more of an opportunity out there through contractors or something else. So, again, how has it changed over time? Are we limiting people's ability to do that? Are we limiting people's ability to find somebody from out of state to come in and do that? I mean, where are the opportunities and obstacles in more aerial hunting?
Yeah, Commissioner Sharp, when we talk about aerial hunting from the general public or from the producer standpoint, there's several components to keep in mind. There's federal regulations that oversee that. There's state law, and then there's administrative rule. I'm not sure if you were on the commission at the time, but just a number of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, there was a gentleman, a producer from Hot Springs area, that he wanted to have a contract pilot come in from Nebraska. Well, the current administrative rule only allowed residents. So the commission did adopt that rule to allow non-residents to be able to come into South Dakota. Since that time, we haven't issued any permits to non-landowners, but nonetheless, the ability to do that is there. And you're absolutely right. You know, 40 or 50 years ago, I think there was a lot of aerial hunting that happened, and that led us down to the road with some of the state statutes and some of the things that are in place now, because I think it was pretty vague on how a lot of things happened, and there was a lot of trespass issues and conflicts. Our agency even got involved more recently here with the lockout in Harding County at the time, because there were aerial hunters that were flying on property that they didn't have permission on, and there was a lot of conflict. So it's a highly regulated activity, again, that has to comply with all those different rules and regulations. But on an average year, we probably issue 15 permits to aerial hunters in South Dakota, whether they're landowners or non-landowner permits. So individuals that have a landowner permit, they can fly their property anytime they want. All they have to do is comply with our reporting requirements and then, of course, the permit process. And then there's non-landowner permits, which in those cases, those individuals can only fly at the discretion of our staff. And that's primarily from a safety standpoint and an efficiency standpoint. You know, if Brad is set up in the morning somewhere and he's got the federal airplane coming in, we want to make sure that he's aware of if there's going to be another airplane that's flying in that individual or individual's area, so we don't have, you know, potential safety concerns. or you know, we wouldn't want somebody out there, perhaps, you know, they get there early in the dark, they've located coyotes, they're going to start calling. Maybe they've got coyotes coming, and all of a sudden here comes an airplane out of nowhere that nobody knew that was going to be in the area. So it's really from a safety and an efficiency area aspect. Did I answer your question?
In a way, yes, thank you. You use the word discretion of staff. Is that discretion of staff based on very specific guidelines or discretion of staff? Explain that a little farther to me, because that can be, I'm just not feeling like you're going to fly today. Type discretion versus, you know, it's ceilings too low, winds at 30, you know, those kinds of things. So guidelines versus discretion, you have me curious.
Yeah, Commissioner Sharp, I would say that probably 95% of the time, if our staff get a request from a non-landowner to fly, they're going to allow them to fly. It would be a rare situation that that wouldn't, you know, that there's a conflict between staff and the pilot, for example, and they're not going to let them fly, because if that happens, I'm going to hear about it. I'm pretty sure Secretary Hepler is going to hear about it. So we really encourage our staff to develop good working relationships with those pilots, so they have, you know, their friends, they're going to respect each other when they're working, where they're working, and make the most efficient uses of everyone's time.
Commissioner Phillips.
Thank you. Question is, you have 28, did you say, hunters working at all times? Do they all document their kills and the methods they use to take them? Do you have good records on how each one, which tools they used every day, and how many coyotes were taken in with every tool?
Yeah, Commissioner Phillips, what we have is a pretty detailed, we call it the private lands database, which all of our wildlife damage staff document what type of work they do on an individual's property, from, you know, how many coyotes they took via traps versus how many coyotes the airplane took, when they responded, when the complaint was received, when it was closed out or it was ended. But yeah, we keep detailed records of all that information.
And that information is available to anybody? I could call you and you could tell me.
Yeah, I mean, as a commissioner, you could call me and say, you know, how many coyotes did we remove on this individual's property, and when and by what methods, and we could get that information, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. A couple of things. Commissioner Olson gave us a long list of detailed questions, which I thought were excellent. And Commissioner Olson shared some of those this morning. But what I want to do, Gary, with your permission, is to then forward it to WMI and ask them to provide answers back to the commission as they go through the review. So there's some sideboards of some questions there, and get the responses back, and also articulate, and I'm sure there is, the differences between how different regions will approach some of those different things. I mean, Brad answered how he would approach, and maybe a different trapper would ask a different way, answer a different way. So that's one point. Two is in particular the producers in the room. You know, we have a governor who's completely committed to going out and eradicating coyotes, if that was even possible. I remember early on in a conversation I had in the governor's office, I got told we manage coyotes. I made it real clear, we don't manage coyotes, we kill them. And we're completely committed to killing them. And there's a distinct difference. I spent a lot of time in Alaska, where we spent a lot of time and money going to intensive management. It's written right in the statute, and I bring that same sentiment back here, and I think Keith and others can attest to that. This independent review, I welcome that opportunity. I think it's a good thing to do. It's a healthy thing to do. It's going to be very transparent. The intent is to have, you know, the reason we ran it through the governor's office, so people wouldn't think somehow we're guiding it ourselves, even though we wouldn't, but that's what people may think. So that's why it's run through the governor's office. When they come back and report, those findings then will be discussed here in a very open forum by the commission, and we'll follow the direction of that commission. I'm completely open to taking whatever action items it says, whatever that potentially means. Another thing, you got asked a question about funding, and in fairness, Keith was diplomatic in his answer. The funding right now we're putting toward wildlife damage, or ADM program, ADC program, is not sustainable. We had the conversation earlier. There's about $400,000 a year this year, for example. We pulled out of one fund, put it in another fund. We made a commitment to get that second airplane, otherwise we're going to lose it. Wildlife Services, we're going to take that and put it in another state. So we made a commitment to paying for that pilot, federal pilot. You know, we have our own state, and I love the same, but Trapper's sitting on the back of that plane. We pay for his salary to fly that, plus we pay the maintenance of that plane. That's about $200,000 a year, $200,000 a year we've committed to. That had come out of somewhere, but sustainably, if you go back and look at this, where we were as far as the balance we had in that fund, where we are now, we are deficit spending. Now, we will do that because we're committed to killing coyotes in this state. But that comes at the expense of other things we do in this department as habitat and everything else. That's a funding source that Tony can use a variety of different ways. Now, we need to rectify that. So I'm hoping, and I'm assuming there'll be some kind of response back from WMI about the funding in this program. And I'm sure the governor's going to ask me the same question, where are we with that? And so we need to figure that out as far as priority. Now, we can prioritize. We have $92 million in both divisions. We can prioritize that in a number of different ways. But as of right now, we are bleeding that, you know, and you heard that from Chris the other day. So, but the bottom line of this thing, we take this thing very seriously, and we know from the producer standpoint how important it is to them. At the same time we're talking about coyotes, I tell you the same passion we hear on coyotes, we're going to also hear on prairie dogs. You know, this year we're blessed with a lot of rain, a lot of green, but in those years it's not. We're going to hear the same thing on the prairie dog side of those things. Then if I'm, you know, someplace where I have, you know, beaver damage or geese damage, I can hear the same from them. So the point of all this is I appreciate we focus on coyotes. I know how important, I grew up in the West. I know how important it is to those producers. But we also have other producers. We have to balance that out because it's our responsibility to look at all of them. You all know that. So the review is for the whole program. This is not coyote-driven. It's for the whole program. And we're looking forward to those results and see how we can work with the commission to help resolve some of those issues. So for the producers in the room, we want you guys involved. We need to hear from you. And if I could figure out some way to remove coyotes from the state of South Dakota, even though I'm sure some people listening say that's not a good thing, I think it would be a good thing, but that can't happen. And mange right now is a hell of a tool for us, and you know, but that means also those populations are at levels causing mange, and so we don't want to get them to those levels if we can. But we're open, and I'm not saying we'd run a perfect program. I know we don't. But if you look Brad in the eye and say, are you sincere about going out and killing coyotes, he'll tell you absolutely. You know, this is the Chris Kyle of the world to go out and do this, and they're completely committed to it. And building those relationships with these producers is incredibly important. Not only here, but when we want to come back and ask you, we want maybe some kids out hunting in your land, we realize this is all part of the package. And so we have to build your trust. You have to trust us. We're going to go out and we take this stuff seriously, because we do. And so I'm off my soapbox, but thank you, and Keith and everybody, Brad. You know, you guys do a wonderful job. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could just add one more thing for Secretary Hepler's comments, is that I'm confident and I know what's going to happen, but one of the questions that WMI will address is the funding adequate and the source of the funding to the program. When we had our kickoff meeting, I'm not sure if you were there that second day, Mr. Secretary, but Tony and I got asked, you know, hours on end, different types of questions, and I know they're going to have an idea or some type of recommendation in regards to what the funding level, if it's adequate or if it needs to be increased, decreased, or what it is, but I know that they'll have some information on that with their final report, so looking forward to seeing that.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, it seems like North Dakota, I mean, our surrounding states must have similar problems, so do they have similar funding mechanisms, or is this one of those subjects where the funding is just completely different from state to state?
Yeah, so every one of those states do have predator control programs, but they're used primarily with federal funds. So South Dakota does receive federal funds. Our agency doesn't, but those funds go to operate one of the aircraft in western South Dakota. And back, I believe, and Emmett Keyser would be a good historian on some of this, but at the time, I think it was in the 70s, there was a certain amount of federal funds that came to every state. And it could either be turned over to the USDA Wildlife Services and have a federally run program, or the state could keep that money and run a state-operated program. In South Dakota, Oklahoma, and I think maybe Texas are only the three states in the United States that kept their federal monies and used it to operate a state program. Well, that created a problem for our agency in the late 2000s when that federal money went away. If you recall, you know, you hear Congress talk about no more earmarks. Well, South Dakota lost those federal funds primarily. We would, at that time, we would get anywhere between $400,000 and $900,000 annual year. Well, that money went away. Now we still receive around $200,000-$250,000 of federal money, but it's used to operate one aircraft, the pilot and the gunner. So that was a change. And for example, in North Dakota, I don't know what their federal allocation is. I'm sure it's significantly more. I think it's around $600,000 or $700,000. And then they also get some money from the State Department. I think the Game and Fish in North Dakota provide around $800,000 to Wildlife Services to do predator control. But every program in every state has different unique funding sources for sure. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
So I believe we're done for today, huh? And then we'll gather in 60 days or whatever that is in September, and everybody have a good time in August. We're adjourned.